be presenting long-distance fieldwork online, case studies in China and Pakistan.
Hello, everyone. Thank you to the last talk of the day. You might as well spend it with me. So what I wanted to do was talk about my experience in using the internet basically to do fieldwork in pretty remote areas. We've had lots of interesting demonstrations and talks at the conference about new kinds of whiz-bang gizmos and applications to do 22nd century language documentation. That ain't this talk. Frankly, I hate technology. It's a cruel irony that I keep having to use it all the time. And so if you're looking for techno whiz-bangery, that's not what's going to go on here. In fact, not only am I a late adopter, I'm the last adopter, okay? So the technology I'm going to talk about very briefly is the stuff that your grandparents are already using, okay? That's kind of where the level is. So when I talk about field work, I'm usually doing sort of larger documentation projects, so it's sort of everything, going into a place where the language is underdocumented, trying to capture everything you can, recordings, transcribing, processing data, and analyzing, et cetera. You all know what all that is about. Of course, also one of the things you want to do is learn about the socio-cultural contexts of where the language is spoken, and that you sort of absorb that when you're there in person. And first, last, and in the middle is building relationships with actual individuals and communities in order to do all those other things. And we all know that, and we do that, but often in these kinds of forums, that's not talked about a lot because it's kind of intangible and you just kind of figure it out. But it looms large when you're trying to do things long distance. So we'll be talking about that quite a bit. Now, technology, of course, has advanced hugely in all of our lifetimes. I'm old enough to remember using a telex machine before the fax was invented. If you're under 30, Google it. And more, even remote areas are being wired for phone or internet. Now, not everywhere. A friend of mine just came back from Papua New Guinea. Field sites don't have electricity, let alone phone or internet, but rural China, wired, right? So we now have a way to get into more remote areas that previously we couldn't get into. Maybe not physically, but maybe online. So this is the notion here. And the technology I'm talking about is the simplest of stuff. Video chatting, file sharing, texting, email, any kind of technology that allows you to have a sustained back and forth conversation allows you to do field work, theoretically. We'll talk about that. So not only can field work be done online, but I think the promise here is that we can expand our language documentation footprint around the world, right? Get more documentation done out there in all different kinds of places. This is kind of the idea. Now, to do a documentation project, linguistic stuff aside, to do a project, as you probably all know, you've got to get time, money, travel, equipment, expertise, build collaboration. These are all requirements. They're also all barriers. If one of these things doesn't work, you don't have a project. Or if one of these things fails, your project falls apart, right? So the promise of long-distance fieldwork is that you can minimize some of these barriers. Some of these barriers might actually go away, or at least become much smaller, theoretically. I'll give you some examples, but this is kind of the idea. Now, I am proud to be an old cranky guy, but I'm actually a new linguist. I just got my PhD in 2015. And my dissertation project was doing field work in China, and now I'm working on a team project in northern Pakistan. So I want to sort of give you some experience, give you an idea of these two projects, and sort of tell you how the long distance thing worked or didn't work, and what's going on there. So for my field work in China, I went to Yunnan province, which is the southwesternmost province in China. It is the province that probably has the most minority peoples and languages spoken there. We got some peeps from Yunnan right here. So this is an ideal place to go do field work, and there's plenty of need to do field work there, by the way, if you're looking for a site. I was documenting a language called Kadzo, which is spoken in a single village. It's endangered, but children are still learning the language. And I planned this as a very traditional fieldwork project. I had no idea of doing anything long distance. So I was going to go there for a year, gather data, go home, process. I live in California. Process it. And then I had budgeted a one-month follow-up trip, which seems quaint looking back, but this is the way it was used to be done, right? To answer everything that I didn't know. Of course, that could have been accomplished in 1 month, clearly. But while I was there, I noticed that they were wiring the village for the internet. And my assistant, a very smart lady, housewife from the village, kind of started to negotiate with me. Well, you know, if you buy me a laptop, because she was kind of intrigued by this laptop thing, if you buy me a laptop, I can do more work for you, and et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, I think there's something here. So I bought her a laptop. She never used a computer before in her life. Bought her a laptop, paid for her particular house to be wired for the internet, taught her how to use the laptop, taught her how to type in Chinese, taught her how to type in the orthography that we were using for my project, signed her up for email and for Skype. I went home, and this is what happened. She then began to transcribe full-time on her own, would just email me the transcripts when she was done. I would add that to the data that I was analyzing, and I'm writing a grammar, and so I would write the next section, and then I would realize, oh, here are the 119 things that I don't know about this morpheme. We would just jump on Skype and then talk about it, right? And so we just kept doing it. So forget the one-month follow-up trip. I had a two-year follow-up trip without leaving California. I mean, this worked brilliantly. It worked brilliantly. It was amazing how well this worked. And I was able to do a much better job on the grammar. I mean, the grammar is like 5 million times better than it would have been otherwise. Of course, my committee was not happy to get a 1,000-page dissertation, but, you know, I feel like I did it, right? So this worked brilliantly, I thought. And I still work with my consultants sporadically. We don't have a lot of time, but we do some stuff now and then. So fast forward a couple years, I got a job at San Jose State, and our department there has a relationship with a university in Pakistan. So the university is called the University of Azad Jammu and Kashmir. It's located in Pakistan-controlled Kashmir, about where the white star is there at the top. And they wanted to do a documentation project to the linguists there and the students, but they'd never done any kind of documentation. They didn't know how to begin to do documentation. And there really is no institutional knowledge in Pakistan about how to do documentation. Maybe you won't be surprised to know that most of the linguists in Pakistan are doing theoretical studies of English, not even Urdu, right? And there's lots of languages, regional languages, small languages spoken in Pakistan. They had identified a language spoken in the very top province in Gilgit province in the Karakoram Mountains that needed some attention. And so they said, would you help us put together a project? So I agreed to do that. The language is called Dawoodi. In the literature, it's known as Domaki. Highly endangered. The youngest speakers we found are in their 30s. We've got maybe 50 to 60 fluent speakers. We didn't do a formal survey, but that seems to be what we found. And they have mostly shifted to regional languages for various reasons. So we planned this to have a long-distance component, right? So the idea was to have a team in Pakistan, 2 faculty members and 4 grad students, and then a team of 2 linguists in San Jose, and much of our work was going to be long distance. So we've got a team in Pakistan doing the stuff on the ground, sort of supported by us in California. So I did go over for 2 weeks to train the students, the team, to do the field work. So it was sort of a mini intense Koh-Lang just for them. And then they went up to the province, and they're 2 different villages, so we had 2 teams and 2 villages simultaneously, kind of a blitzkrieg approach, gather a bunch of data, and then they brought with them 2 native speakers back to the university in Kashmir, where they are living, and they're all processing the data, and they've been doing that for about a year and a half. My role from San Jose is basically sort of leading the team, supervising the team, managing them, problem solving, troubleshooting, all that kind of stuff. It includes some day working with data, but I'm not actually working directly with speakers. Speakers don't speak English, I don't speak Urdu, so that's the kind of thing that's going on. So this project, not going so well as the China project, for a lot of reasons. One, it's larger, it's more complex, more people, more moving parts. We've also been beset by technology problems, logistical problems, personnel problems, speaker problems, socio-political problems, all of which we foresaw. We just didn't foresee that they would all happen simultaneously every day that we've been doing the project. So work is happening. We are doing things. We are accomplishing things. It's just moving much more slowly than the China project. So I think they're okay. They're feeling okay on the team. On Pakistan, I'm highly frustrated. But we're doing what we can do. So how do I feel about this, the promise of long-distance fieldwork now? Well, I still think it's a good idea, right? I still think that it works because a lot of the pros still exist, right? So a lot of those barriers can be taken away. So I work full-time now, but I'm not limited to just waiting till my summer break to like race to some field site and try to do something really fast and come home. I can be working on stuff every day of every day that I want to work on it, right? It's much cheaper, right? So, okay, in China, I paid for the laptop out of pocket for my assistant, but it was so worth it. Team in Pakistan, they're at university. They already have computers, they already have laptops, they know how to do all that, use all that stuff, they got internet connection, right? So that becomes a much cheaper project. So obviously, if you don't have to travel somewhere, then that saves you time and money. But also, as many of you know, getting there may be easy, getting permission to do work there may be some other thing that you've got to solve, right? So both places, China and Pakistan, the permission process to do work on the ground is not transparent. You did not always know if you were going to get permission. You may be there already in country waiting and maybe being led to believe you are about to get permission, and you may never get permission, right? So I don't have those problems long distance, right? So that doesn't come into play, which is great, right? Again, you could ideally get more work done in a shorter time or go deeper in a longer period of time. And again, we can share expertise. So not only in Pakistan are we specifically documenting Dawoodi, but I am training the team there, faculty and staff, to do language documentation, which they can continue to do for their lifetimes, right? Long after I'm gone, right? So this is sort of one of the promises here, one of the benefits that can happen, because it's not easy for everyone to come to ICLDC or Colang, especially if you are someplace where that's really expensive to travel here, or you're in a country that our administration doesn't like very much anymore, right? So things get very complicated. But this can maybe short circuit some of that. Cons, of course, there are cons. It's real life. You've got trade-offs. So obviously, if you're doing stuff long distance, you're doing it through technology, and therefore technology becomes, psychologically, it becomes the end-all and be-all. So if you have tech problems, that just becomes super dramatic to you. When I was doing field work in person in the village in China, sometimes I show up to the village and no electricity for the day. Okay, we just do something else, and then I'll just come back tomorrow, right? That works fine. Pakistan, I work full time, they work full time, time zones are horrendous, we're exactly 12 hours apart, so we've got 1 hour during the day when we can meet to have a meeting, and then if that meeting doesn't happen, then you start to flip out, because you gotta wait till the next week to have that one meeting, right? So, and if you have several weeks in a row where that doesn't pan out very well, then you really start to get nervous. I mean, it's a multi-year project, but still, you start to feel like time's passing me by, right? That's a problem. There's some other weird technology issues that come up. So in China, you may be aware of the Great Firewall. Has anyone heard of this phrase, right? So how, for those of you who don't know, how can I put this politely? The Chinese government reserves the right to be an uninvited participant in all conversations that happen online within China. So, I don't love that, but I'm fine with that. We're not talking about any sensitive material in my work, right? But many American-based products that you might normally turn to opt out of that and don't work in China. So anything Google own or run doesn't work. Dropbox doesn't work. Even using Gmail to email someone in China, iffy, right? Facebook blocked, blogs blocked, right? Now, all those products exist in China. They've all got that, all those kind of products, but I've not had a good luck in trying to use any of them and downloading and using them in the US. So there's that issue. Of course, for my China product, I left a copy of all entire archive of all the recordings there with my assistant, so we don't need to, you know, trade, you know, big files and stuff. But that's one thing. Pakistan kind of has the very opposite issue. Not too much government interference, but not enough. The infrastructure in Pakistan is just not good. So the university town where my team is, 650,000 people, the internet is much worse than in rural China. So we find that it has to be a really good day to be able to use Skype. Just the connection is not good enough. They have trouble uploading and downloading documents to our shared drive. We often have our conference calls using WhatsApp, which means if I've got five people sitting around a single cell phone in Pakistan, not conducive to a real substantive conversation, right? So again, one of our little problems that's sort of slowing that whole thing down. Long distance payment is a nightmare, no matter how you're trying to do it. So is there anyone here from the US Treasury Department? Okay, so in China, here was my workaround. At this point, I was basically paying out of my pocket or basically using a stipend that, right, so not NSF funds, just to be clear. So I made several back and forth trips during my year in China. So what I did was, seeing that this was maybe gonna, I was gonna be working after I left the country, I opened up a separate bank account at Bank of America where I have my personal account. It allows me to transfer funds into it. It has its own ATM card, and I gave that to my assistant in China. So the beauty of this is that within minutes, I can get an invoice from her, I can give her the money, she can have it access to within minutes. She has an ATM card with my name on it, which in China, but works at most banks, right? So that works pretty well. She's only been detained once and it was only for an hour. In Pakistan, this is a university to university transfer of funds. So we're using the international banking system, you know, international wire transfers. This is a horrible system. I don't know how much experience you have with this. So it takes between 2 weeks or 2 months for funds to reach my team members. It goes through multiple banks, and no one bank can tell you where the money is. Once it leaves one bank, they don't know where it's gone. I mean, they know where they sent it, but they don't know if it's there or if it's at the third bank, or no one knows. It's awful. It's an awful, awful system. So this is a problem. Payment is maybe one big problem here for this system. There's some other workarounds, maybe. But what I notice is really the stuff that really keeps coming back to me is that the interpersonal communication stuff is what is kind of a sticking point as well. So when you're with, I mean, you see this at this conference, right? So you're waiting in line for lunch, or you're sitting next to someone before a talk starts, you chit-chat about whatever, right? And you start to build a relationship. That's how you build a relationship with people, right? But if you can only talk to your team for 1 hour a week, and you're not sure if even you're gonna get the whole hour, and you've got a long to-do list, and they've got a long to-do list, the thing that never happens is the chit-chat, right? And so it's not like that detracts from the relationship, but you're not deepening the relationship through those online interactions, right? There's also, you have less presence and less control, right? So when I was in the village in China, I mean, normal Chinese village life is that my assistant would work at home, she's a seamstress by trade, and her friends and relatives and clients would all just come barge into her house and ask her to come do this immediately and go do that, and they need this and whatever, and this is how it all works, right? So when I was there, those people graciously stayed the hell out of our way. Like, they knew that we were working on this thing, and so they didn't do that to her. But when I left the village, even though she's still working for me full time, I'm not there. For them, I'm out of sight, out of mind. And so she's now inundated with all of those disruptions, and it's harder for her to push back on those, to keep, you know, working at a pace. In Pakistan, I'm now kind of a boss, right? I'm directing a team. And so as a boss, you want to be able to use your carrots and your sticks to keep the project going in the right way. Carrots and sticks don't work so well over the internet. Carrots aren't as tasty. Sticks aren't as painful. So it's a little harder to make sure that stuff is going the way you want it to go. And you're not there, so sometimes you don't realize until stuff has drifted, you know, a week or two, and you're like, what? So that's a bit of a problem. Obviously, you're not getting any socio-cultural context, right? So you just see a face on a screen, right? So you're always expecting intercultural issues when you do field work. Whenever you're an outsider and you go into some culture, whether you're a tourist or a field worker, whatever, you expect to run into that kind of thing. If you're there in person, okay, first of all, you can tell by the horrified looks on people's faces that you did something wrong. You can then look appropriately embarrassed and apologetic immediately, and then you can work through whatever that issue is, right? Well, online, that's much harder to do, right? So think about this. You've done this with your best friends, right? The wrong smiley face on the wrong text, and like your best friend's mad at you for a day. So think about doing this online, right? So I'm not there to see the emails I send my team in Pakistan. So, you know, they could be horrified at what I've said. I have no idea. I may not ever know. And they're like, just, you know, they're like black marks against my name, and I just never know. Or maybe I find out a week later, but it's a week of them grumbling like, oh, I can't believe it. And then I got more amends to make, right? So that obviously then becomes a little bit more complicated and a little more difficult. So I've seen the good, I've seen the bad. So how do I still feel about this? Well, personally, I think in-person field work is better. However, that may be generational. Remember my comment about technology. I didn't grow up living my social life online. I still do not live my social life online. So I would always rather just sit down with somebody, right? But that's not always possible. I would say, from my experience, online field work works best if you first have spent time together in person to really build that deep relationship. Then you can move it online, and then you don't have a lot of these issues. You've got sort of the social capital. So my assistant in China and I worked side by side, 5 days a week for an entire year doing field work. She saw exactly what I was doing, how I was doing it, what I was aiming for, what her role is, how she could fit in. She was sitting by me transcribing for many, many months so she could go do it. We became really close friends. So working online seemed very seamless, and I didn't have to think about these issues. So when things happen, because they do, like when she wiped her entire hard drive of all of our data, we laughed about it. Well, I laughed about it online. I cried after the call was over, but right. But you can do it. Now, I know my pals in Pakistan, they're great people. We get along really well, but I did not spend a year side by side with them, right? We do not have that deep of a relationship. So we get along well, but it's just not as deep. It's more superficial, it's more businesslike, and of course, because there's no chit-chat, it's remaining that, right? And potentially, we could actually, some of our issues might actually be able to be resolved if we just knew each other better, maybe. You know, they're still a little hesitant to say they don't know something or that they made a mistake or whatever, right? So then that takes longer just to detect and solve. But on the other hand, there is such a huge need for documentation all over the world, right? That I think it's still much better to do a difficult and maybe even a not so great job online than not doing anything at all. I mean, the days I really feel frustrated about the problems we're having with the Pakistan project, I just stop and think about the Dawoodi speakers. This language is so endangered. It's not like there's another better team that could just swoop in. It's not like we're like holding anyone up and doing a better job. There's no one else to do the job, right? It's us or no one. So that makes it worthwhile. And I think that there are many parts of the world that could benefit from this. Having a linguist on tap. Think about a community activist who kind of knows basically what they want to do, but maybe they need to ask a question now and then, right? Would be great if they could just Skype somebody and not necessarily have to have a linguist underfoot, right? So I still think this is a good idea. I still think it has a lot of promise. Doesn't work in every site, doesn't work in every situation, but a lot can be accomplished. And so I think we can, if we keep working on it, we can maybe hone this a little better. So thank you very much. I'll be happy to take your questions.
Yes? Yeah, thank you very much. This is great to hear someone else grappling with some of these issues. I did a very small project all on distance, but fortunately had a local linguist helping kind of in the interview. But I was wondering, assuming, of course, that we can't do it in person, which is ideal, what would be your ideal design of a combination or long-distance, just long-distance project? How would you plan that out?
Well, you need, I mean, you really need active, enthusiastic people on the other end, for one thing, to be motivated to try to work through the issues. I mean, I think really any kind of project could work. It sort of depends if you are, well, it kind of depends what kind of situation. If you're actually working directly with the speaker, I mean, ideally you'd want them to be able to loop in other speakers or maybe make recordings for other speakers, as opposed to, you know, working with a team that's doing stuff on the ground and then you just sort of direct the people who already kind of know some stuff. So I don't know, I think it really depends on the situation. I don't know if I have an ideal. Make sure there's good internet connection. That would be my one. And the payment thing, yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for this talk. I'm really interested in this stuff, and I've done a little bit of my own. I work with communities in East Africa, and there are a lot of reasons that this kind of work is really beneficial for projects in that region, because there's a lot of mobile infrastructure, even in very rural areas.
Right.
And I've tended to give community members mobile technology to do this kind of work. It's just not always electricity, even when there's mobile data. And it helps a lot with circumventing a lot of issues, like you mentioned, with permissions, and then corruption, just having to pay for research permits, things like that. You don't have to do any of those things when you can reach people directly, just work with them directly. Also, one other technology that is in East Africa, and I don't know if this is really present in the areas where you're still working, is mobile money. So in East Africa, people can have mobile money bank accounts associated with their mobile accounts. And you can transfer money to them within like 24 hours from a U.S. bank account to their account. So I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't looked in that. That might work in China and Pakistan because it's NSF administered by the university, we have to go through
that's
official channels in that regard. So.
The only other thing I wanted to add is I found that this kind of work is best after you've already created primary data. So you've done audiovisual recording, and then you want transcriptions, translations, things like that. So you can focus your time in the field on collecting that primary data, and then kind of not worry so much about doing the transcriptions and translations until you're already back, and then you can be working on those the whole time that you're gone.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I did for China. Of course, in Pakistan, there are people gathering the primary data there, and I'm not there doing that. I kind of miss that piece, but it works. Margaret?
A comment and a question, Chris. Comment is, I think it'd be really interesting to get into what the point that sort of slid by right at the very end, benefits to the community. And I think that one of those that you said that could be amplified is not having a linguist underfoot. You know, like I think for a lot of us, we've worked in communities, particularly in remote communities, where it's really onerous for a community to have us there for a period of time. So, you know, but it'd be great to hear more about other benefits for the community, from the community side as well as from this side. But the question is about when you were doing the distance work, particularly in China, were you recording?
I did not, because I generally don't have the practice of recording the, you know, minute by minute discussions about stuff, because frankly, a lot, you know, there's a lot of time eaten up with stuff that's really not viable to keep. So I was basically at that point, I was, you know, already knew how to transcribe very quickly. So I was just taking notes as we were chatting. But that you could definitely do that. We would sometimes play recordings that we'd made of other people and discuss them over Skype. But I wasn't recording myself.
Thank you. And I wonder about the quality of that if you're making recordings, if you're doing some more sort of storytelling, or not just kind of the checking work, but the actual.
Yeah, so I've not done that. I mean, I would say, obviously, if you really want clear recordings, or especially if you're doing some kind of phonetic analysis, you wouldn't want to do anything online. I mean, you'd much rather be there in person. But again, after you have some your basic data down, you could do that. As far as the communities I work in are very socially, politically, economically disadvantaged, and preserving their languages is low on their priorities. So they're happy to see us there to do this work, but they don't really want to do any of it, right? So it's a very different model. I mean, they're not, you know, we try to get them interested and involved and help shape the project, but often they don't know, they don't care. Do whatever you want. We're happy to, you know, you can record me, whatever, but yeah, don't ask me to translate. And, you know, I got karaoke to sing or whatever, so... So very different models than a lot of what we hear at conferences like this, where communities are very active and playing a role or leading the project, not what we find in many other places.
I think that's about it.
Oh.
So we're out of time, but you're welcome to continue the discussion afterwards. So thank you very much.
Thank you.